AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Italian ships and planes scrambling to find survivors of a migrant ship that's capsized north of Libya in the Mediterranean. The AP's Nicole Winfield reports up to 700 people were crammed onto that boat.
What we know is that a fishing boat did capsize north of Libya. A massive sea and air search and rescue operation is underway. But the exact toll, we don't know. News reports say so far only 28 people have been rescued.
There's been a huge jump in migrants from across Africa leaving from Libya for Italy this year. Estimated 900 have died trying to make the crossing in overcrowded and unsafe ships and boats. In about an hour, a ceremony will get underway in Oklahoma City to mark the 20th anniversary of the bombing that killed 168 people. Bud Welch, whose daughter Julie was killed that day in 1995, says he's learned to forgive the bomber Timothy McVeigh and his accomplice Terry Nichols.
That does not mean that I have forgotten Julie. I have not. I have not gotten over the loss of her, because a parent never gets over that when they lose a child.
Serious problems uncovered inside a key FBI forensics unit. AP's Mike Gracia tells us more.
In a stunning admission, the Justice Department and FBI have formally acknowledged that nearly every examiner in the FBI laboratory's microscopic hair comparison unit gave flawed testimony in nearly every trial in which they offered evidence over more than 20 years prior to 2000. The Washington Post reports in over 95% of the 268 trials reviewed so far, examiners overstated forensic matches in a manner that favored prosecutors. That includes cases where 32 defendants were sentenced to death, 14 of which were executed or died in prison. Mike Gracia, Washington.
The Post reports hundreds of defendants and federal and state prosecutors have been told. This is AP Radio News. Republican presidential hopefuls find a common theme in New Hampshire.
Senator Rand Paul said Clinton's handling of Benghazi and other matters while Secretary of State should preclude her from holding higher office.
I'm starting to worry that when Hillary Clinton travels, there's going to need to be two planes, one for her and her entourage and one for her baggage.
Carly Fiorina said Clinton has nothing to run on.
She does not have a track record of accomplishment.
And there was this from Senator Lindsey Graham.
This listening tour is something out of North Korea. Would you like to meet the dear leader and ask him anything you would like?
Clinton will be here in New Hampshire tomorrow and Tuesday. Jerry Bodlander, Nashua, New Hampshire.
Clinton is also courting the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. Her campaign says she wants campaign financing limits, constitutional protection of same-sex marriage, as well as driver's licenses for people in the country illegally. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Hey, everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
Mike is back in studio. He's talking about what's going on at his very hot Pearl Dive. And Passover is coming. That means Paula Scheuer is coming in. She's got incredible Passover desserts.
That's Foodie and the Beast this Sunday and every Sunday at 11 right here on 1500 AM.
This is Mark Amtower. With lower margins, your limited marketing budget has to work harder than ever. LinkedIn is one of the most robust marketing platforms available. With over 350 million members worldwide, 110 million in the U.S., and 3.1 million members within 50 miles of this station, I guarantee your customers and prospects are here. Connect, influence, motivate, create leads. I can show you how. When you want to maximize the return on your LinkedIn presence, email me at mark@federaldirect.net.
The Jubilee Association of Maryland provides community support services for adults with developmental disabilities so they can live happy and productive lives close to family and friends. Join Jubilee as they toast Congressman Chris Van Hollen at their annual gala on April 20th in Bethesda. Make a difference in the lives of adults with intellectual and other developmental disabilities. Buy your tickets today. Reservations and sponsorships at jubileemd.org.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up
at 5. For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Tyson's Corner offices of Offutt Perman Law Firm. This is your host, Dana Theus of InPowerCoaching.com, with my co-hosts, Mark Cohen, Jim Rees, Kristen Vazo, and Lee Doherty. We are here with a great lineup of guests for you today. Mark, would you like to read off who's here with us?
Sure, Dana. We're going to start with Jerry Carlson, the Washington Metro Area Managing Partner of KPMG LLP. Then we'll talk to Robert Bainham, the founder and CEO of the Woodlands Retirement Community. Third is Marie Clark Brill, Executive Director of ActionAid USA. And we'll end up today with Tony Braddock, the owner and CEO of Lock Harbor Group.
Great. Let's get started with Jerry Carlson, Washington Metro Area Managing Partner of KPMG LLP. Jerry, what is KPMG LLP?
KPMG LLP is an auditing, tax, and advisory firm, and we have a higher purpose of helping companies to fulfill their responsibilities to their shareholders and to fulfill their commitments within the community.
And what? How big is the Washington, D.C. metro area that you manage?
So our Washington metro area offices comprise about 2,350 people. And then from a U.S. perspective, we've got about 28,000 people. And then across the globe, we have 160,000.
So you manage a very big partnership. What do you do so uniquely that makes you successful managing so many amazing people?
Well, I think the main thing is trying to stay connected to the people day in and day out. I go to work each day with the belief that I'm there to work for them. And I truly believe in the concepts of servant leadership. And so when I go into the office, my question to myself is, what can I do to help our people be better each and every day, to help them get done what they need to get done both today and to position themselves for success in the future?
So this doesn't sound like the typical leader we think of as just telling everybody what to do. This sounds, talk about servant leadership. What does that really mean?
Well, I think the main thing is, one, being closely connected and understand that there are a great deal of demands on our people today. And I reflect on the past when I think back to the early stages of my career. I'm now in my 34th year with the firm, and I look at the partners of that time. There was a much easier ability to disconnect, and the people of today don't have that ability to disconnect, so they're constantly engaged with their clients. So there are things that strategically need to be happening to support them, and so I help them in those strategic matters that need to be executed.
So you realize that when you have strong connections to your people and they're supported, they're doing better work for the client.
Absolutely, because in the end it's all about making sure that we deliver a quality product to our clients.
So how young were you when you realized that when you connected to other people, good things happened?
I think it was really in the middle of high school. I grew up, the formative years in the Washington metro area, in the Northern Virginia, Bailey's Crossroads area, in fact. And then at a ripe age of 14, I made a critical move with my father, who was a career Army officer. And we moved to mid-Missouri, and as a result of that, I realized that I went from an environment where I knew people around me, to an environment where I knew nobody. And so I had to open up and go from being fairly introverted to being extroverted and getting to know the people around me.
So can you tell us more about that? What was required to get you to open up and start becoming an extrovert?
Well, literally being plunked down into a community high school that most of the people there knew each other and had spent a long time growing up together, had gone to grade school together, and were now in high school, and suddenly there was this new kid on the block walking in, and in fact, I adopted a new name all of a sudden because I had the initials JC on the back of my backpack. So suddenly I went from being Jerry to being JC in the community, and I had to really start to open up and reach out and make friends and understand how I could better connect to people. So it was that move specifically.
Were you in sports at all in high school?
I was. Through my formative years growing up, I was a swimmer and a runner, and I also got involved in wrestling, so I carried that all the way through my high school years and actively was serving in individual sports, but with the hopes of better improving the teams around me.
Yeah, so tell us about that. You're a team manager now.
Right.
And one would have thought, well, you would have gone to team sports mm-hmm. when you were a kid, but you didn't.
No, I tended to focus on the individual sports. And I think a lot of that was, I reflect back on my father, and I'll say the formative things that he focused on. He always told me you need to be fitness-oriented and focused and active. So he was a runner. He ran every day at lunch at the Pentagon. He had a five-mile loop that he felt gave him the ability to manage his stress and stay balanced. And so I picked that up from him and adopted that from a sports standpoint. But I also realized that I couldn't go out and succeed, win my match or win my race, and have the team end up losing and then feel like I was being successful. So I think while the individual activities were driving me, I think it was being a part of that team that was a real key point for me.
And that's what makes you so natural as a manager with a lot of partners.
I'd like to think that, Mark. Okay. I think it's helpful because, in the end, I think they know that I'm there for them and that I'm going to support them actively. And they also know I like to compete. So when they're out there competing, I'm there to support them and be behind them.
Jerry, we talked a little bit about your relationship with your dad. What was the relationship like with your mother growing up, and how do you think that shaped who you are today?
Yeah. Well, I will say this, that nickname of JC became a heavily accented name because she grew up in Tennessee, so it had multiple syllables, JC. So she loved to yell for me and cheer for me in sports. But the thing that she really drove was the need to engage with people and to respect the people around me. She was a big believer in the underdog, and so she always liked to root for, and I still remember the game where Christian Laettner shot the shot to beat Kentucky at the end of the game. They were showing it just recently in the tournament. She was furious because Duke was the glory team at that time, and she wanted to see Kentucky win. They were the underdog, but she always rooted for that underdog, and I think a big part of that was the respect for people around you.
So I'm curious, do you root for the underdog? Did you bring that into your value system?
I think part of that's what's helped me to drive that competitive nature. So, I mentioned I'm still involved with fitness. I still like to run. I like to cycle. I'm a golfer. While I appreciate the Tiger Woods of today, I also appreciate the young guy who's coming out that's trying to make a name for himself and has the ability to be that 10 cup and win the tournament and advance themselves.
So I'm curious, does that rooting for the underdog really pay off in business?
I think it does, because I think it helps people to realize that you may go into a situation as an assessment that you're at a competitive disadvantage, but that competitive disadvantage is just something that you have to address, and you have to then figure out the solution for. We call it red flags. You got to go out and figure out what those red flags are and how you cure those. And many times it's about building relationships. And because of that, I think that, looking at opportunities where we may feel like we're the underdog, I think you can identify paths to win, and you just need to be more strategic about it.
Well, it strikes me, too, that when you're cheering for the underdog, you're believing they can win.
Absolutely.
And if you feel like you're at a competitive disadvantage, you've got to believe you can win if you have any chance whatsoever.
Yeah. And you have to have that core belief. You have to also be willing to go a bit above and beyond. You've got to be in a position where you're going to do a bit more than your competitor might do, from the standpoint that you have to be actively engaged. You've got to be willing to stretch yourself, stretch your team, and be in a position where you're doing more than the others to make sure you're going to win.
So you talked about your dad being at the Pentagon, and it sounded, when we talked earlier, like there was a lot of interesting things going on in your family.
So he was there during the period of the Vietnam War, and when he returned from Vietnam, he had the benefit to serve on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he was part of the briefing team for Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird and Henry Kissinger. So he had to be at the White House each and every morning by 5:30. And so, you know, he worked a lot of hours. And so, you know, that helped to form what I believed as a concept that you were totally dedicated to your work, that it wasn't about the hours, it wasn't a 40-hour job, but also you were dedicated from a standpoint of personal commitment. And I think that's driven a big part of the reason why, you know, here I'm at 34 years and I've had the same job. I've been in, well, not the same job, really, because I've moved to a lot of different jobs within my career, but that I've stayed within the same firm.
Are you more like your mom or your dad?
Yes. I would say I'm a combination of both.
The best parts, of course.
Truly am. I wouldn't say the best, but I'm a combination of both. My father was a hard worker. There are probably times when I'd say I probably spent too much time focused on that, and I reflect back. I was fortunate enough to have a spouse who I now refer to, since I'm in Washington, as the First Lady, who was a phenomenal mother and raised our children in a great way.
What's the website?
KPMG.com.
This is Dana Theis. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. Welcome to this Business Spotlight. What's your name?
Hi, my name is Brenda Walker, and I'm a partner at KPMG.
What is KPMG?
KPMG is one of the big four accounting firms, and we're the fastest growing big four. We operate in over 155 countries with 160,000 people globally and with over $24 billion annual revenues.
What makes your business special?
Well, here at KPMG, we believe we each have a higher purpose. We, of course, are accountants, as you would think, auditors and consultants, but we take the view that every day when we do our work, it makes a positive impact, not just a positive impact for our firm or our clients, but also for society as a whole. For example, we may be providing project management or audit readiness services to the Department of Defense, but what we really are impacting is protecting our national security.
What do you love personally about your job?
My favorite part about the job is working with people. I really enjoy helping our staff grow their careers. I enjoy helping our clients with their careers and their challenges. And I enjoy being able to bring and solve problems, or bring solutions and solve problems for them.
What's the website?
It's www.kpmg.com.
Welcome to this Business Spotlight. What's your name?
Hi, my name is Brenda Walker, and I'm a partner at KPMG.
What's KPMG?
KPMG is one of the big four accounting firms and the fastest growing. Our U.S. practice has over 80 offices and 23,000 partners and staff. We provide audit, tax, and advisory services across multiple industries, such as financial services, energy, healthcare and life sciences, manufacturing, and my favorite, government and public sector.
What do you like most about your job?
I like working with people the most. I feel that our consulting advisory practice is all about the people, and I enjoy helping our people and our staff members grow their careers, as well as our clients growing their careers in their organizations.
Why is KPMG a great place for everyone to work?
KPMG has a great diversity and inclusion culture. We are a very friendly culture. We enjoy each other. We have a lot of activities outside of just work, and we really provide the most friendly culture, I think, of all the big fours.
What's the website?
It's www.kpmg.com.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis. Next up, we have Robert Branham, CEO of the Woodlands Retirement Community. Robert, what is the Woodlands Retirement Community?
We take care of about 130 people in a retirement community, plus we take care of 1,000 people a year in a 200-bed nursing home called Fairfax Nursing Center. And then we take care of 130 people in gardens-assisted living. So we have 450 elderly people we're taking care of, plus the average stay in a nursing home today is only 29 days. So we take care of about 1,000 patients there a year.
Why is taking care of people so important to you personally?
Well, we see people that are come from the hospital that need to be healed. They've been in the hospital 3 days, and they've had surgery. And then you see them in therapy, speech therapy or physical therapy or occupational therapy, and you see them getting better. And then you see them wanting to go home. So, and that's the good news. When they're there for a short time, they get healed and they go home. So that makes us feel good. And at the retirement community, half the people were living alone, eating alone every meal for months, maybe. And they move in, and then you see them with a group of three or four other people at a table, and they're laughing and having fun. And that's a real thrill to me.
So when you were growing up, were your parents taking care of people? Where did you get this drive? What were you doing as a kid?
Well, I was rambunctious, but my mother, about five things happened to me in my growing up. My mother and father taught me truth and honesty. School taught me diligence. Church taught me character, I hope. And a book I read influenced me a lot. And a lady that I hardly knew helped me. It was very important in the development of my businesses.
So tell us a story about your mom teaching you truth.
Well, she insisted that we always tell the truth to her and to everybody else. And if we didn't tell the truth, we had to go back and amend it with the people. And honesty, she was honest to the penny. And that impressed me.
You, in the earlier conversation, you talked about this book. Tell us about the book that changed your business life.
Well, there was a book written by The Seven Rules of Money by a fellow named Phillips. He was a fellow that developed a Good Earth catalog. He made millions, and he sold it. And then he wrote a book. And in that book, I learned something very important, that things happen because individuals have ideas and they follow the idea. It's not because it took money to do it, because most people, when you suggest something to them, they say, well, I don't have the money to do that. But he said that money comes way down at the bottom. It's maybe number seven on ideas how to do something. I was in Bangkok, I was working there, and I took a weekend off and went to a hospital in Malaysia. And I was having lunch with the hospital administrator, and he said, I asked him, I said, how's your hospital doing? He said, we're doing terrifically, but we got one big problem. I said, what's the problem? He said, we need an addition. And I said, why don't you build it? And he gave me the standard answer, we don't have the money. I said, that's not the reason. He said, what do you mean? So I took a napkin and I wrote down, I said, did you get an option on the land next door? Did you get permission from your board to have the architect draw up the plans? Did you do this? Do you do that? And about seven or eight things. And then I said, did you open a building fund? He said, no. So I gave him a $100 bill, and I said, open up the Haji Hospital Building Fund. And then I got back on a train and came back to Bangkok and back to work. A year and a half later, I walked into a church, and this administrator was preaching. And he stopped his sermon when he saw me and introduced me to the congregation. And then he said,
And he told the story of the napkin. And he said, I did that thing, each of those things, and we have our audition now, and it's working well.
So with a simple story out of a book, you helped build a hospital.
Yeah, and I've used that 100 times in other places, in my own work and other people, in nonprofits and other things.
Now, one thing about building so many businesses as you have is you've experienced success and you've experienced risk and failure, too. And I love the story of the lady because as we when you first told us that, we thought, oh, that must be his wife. But it wasn't. It was somebody out of the blue.
Right. He was a volunteer, and I hardly knew her. And I had opened up the 200-bed nursing home in Fairfax, Virginia, in 1964. At the same time, I didn't realize that 29 other nursing homes opened up in the Washington metropolitan area. We all had a problem. It was overbedded. And so a group of us met with the HUD, that some of the homes were financed with HUD, and they agreed to forego payments for a while to help with our situation. But that wasn't enough. The builder wanted to be paid the rest of the money for the construction, and I owed him $50,000. And I said, look, I can't do it. The only thing I can do is give you the nursing home if you want it. So I signed a deed over to him. And I started looking for a job that day. I thought, I'm out of business. And the next day, he brought the deed back and said, look, one of the partners' wives of us raised so much cane that we took this man's nursing home, give it back to him. I was a volunteer there, and I didn't see the good they were doing. So that lady saved me, and through the years, that nursing home has generated millions of dollars to help other projects.
So I'm curious about the other story. You were in Bangkok, but you were also trying to run nursing home and elder facilities here in Fairfax. So why were you in Bangkok?
Well, I created Volunteers International, and we took volunteers to Thailand to work in refugee camps, and that organization performed for several years. Then we merged with another organization, and they're still going. They're building hundreds of schools. One-day schools. They can build a school in one day, and they build hundreds of schools throughout the world in 28 countries, I think.
What's the website?
Oh, my website is www.thewoodlandsccrc.com.
This is Dana Theus. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is Isabella Fuentes, Marketing Director at BusinessWise CPAs. Isabella, what is BusinessWise CPAs?
BusinessWise CPA supports government contractors, small businesses, and nonprofits with outsourced CFO and financial consulting services.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the marketing director.
And as a marketing director, what does that mean?
Well, I actually wear several hats. My primary role is to improve and extend the branding of BusinessWise CPA through referrals, client meetings, networking in the D.C. area. Mm-hmm. As well as supporting current client relationships.
And what do you like most about your job?
I like the most that I don't have to be at a desk all day. I'm out and about meeting new folks and learning experiences from other entrepreneurs.
Great. What makes your organization so special in your view?
I believe our added value is that we are not just a number report kind of type firm. We're very much integrated with our clients. They rely on us for all important decisions. We help them not only with the numbers, but on the future growth of the business.
And what is it that the clients appreciate most about the company?
That they can call us and they talk to the same person every time.
Okay, and who's the perfect client?
Perfect client is small to mid-size organization looking to save on a full-time employee and as well as get the added value of the consulting.
Great. What's the website for the company?
www.businesswisecpa.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Isabella Fuentes, Marketing Director at BusinessWise CPAs. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Randy Tharp, Director of the 5-9 Group. Welcome, Randy. Randy, what is the 5-9 Group?
The 5-9 Group is an IT services company here in D.C., and we provide application solutions, DevOps, and program management for the federal government.
Mm-hmm. And what's your role in the company?
I'm the Director of Business Development.
So that means what?
So that means I'm the guy responsible for gaining new business.
Mm-hmm. And so what is it that makes the organization special in your view?
Well, the company was created out of the role that they play. It's called 5-9, so 99.999% availability is what our goal is, to serve our customers.
And what do they appreciate about you guys?
They appreciate that we can actually deliver that.
Mm-hmm. And who is the perfect client in your mind?
The perfect client is one who understands that we are one of the leaders and we're the innovators behind them, and they hired us for a reason and they let us do our jobs.
And what is it about the work that you enjoy most?
Well, the work we enjoy the most is because it's on high availability critical systems for the federal government. For example, DHS or Census Bureau, managing these databases are very important to the taxpayers and to America, so we take that very serious.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say that the clients get from all this work? Where's the value in it for them?
The value is being able to count on an industry leader, on a contractor like us, to get the job done and be available 24/7 to keep things going for them and bring solutions that matter.
That's great. And you got a website?
We do. It's www.59group.com.
Thanks, Randy. We've been speaking with Randy Tharp, Director, 5-9 Group. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. You can hear the show again at businesstalkradio.net.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theus. Next up, we have Marie Clark Brill, Executive Director of ActionAid USA. Marie, what is ActionAid USA?
Thank you for having me. ActionAid USA is the U.S. office of an international federation of organizations in 47 countries that defend human rights and help promote sustainable development around the world.
So how big or small is ActionAid USA?
Well, ActionAid USA helps to fund this 300 million euro federation, but we're actually a pretty small shop here in the Washington metro area with only 20 staff, and that's because we raise resources and channel them to development and human rights programs around the world. But we also have a team of advocates that support policy changes at the global level in order to be able to enhance people's ability to claim their rights.
So when you go to work every day, You find yourself doing something unique that you've done over and over and over in your career, you were telling us. What is that thing that you do that's so special?
Well, I'm a change maker. I think that's the thing that can characterize my leadership in each place. And at ActionAid, have also been a part of building a really big change in the organization. We radically shifted our business model so that we could really aggressively put capital towards our growth and to be able to leverage so much more resources to the work that's happening internationally. But change making is really about building a coalition of people that can really engage the same vision and drive it forward. And I think that's the piece that I enjoy every day.
So change making on an international scale is daunting to even think about. What prepared you for doing this so successfully?
I think Actually, this is the nice thing about ActionAid, because it resonates with my own personal experience, that each one of us are change makers in our lives. And people living in poverty and exclusion around the world are the first agents of change.
And you saw this growing
and
up,
I've
didn't
seen
you?
That growing up, and I've seen it time and again. And I'm actually motivated by seeing the excitement, especially of, for example, a woman smallholder farmer who has been given the capacity to be able to analyze agriculture budgets, advocate with other women smallholder farmers to grow her business, because she is an entrepreneur. She is her first investor in her own farm, and she is the one that will make a change in her life and in her community. And I bring that to work every day in thinking about how can I be the first investor in this work and to build change.
So when you were a kid, you had some really interesting experiences that gave you insight into this, but one of them required that you take French lessons, which you do not like. So tell us, why were you taking French lessons in Romania, wasn't it?
That's right. Well, I was living in Romania. It was under the totalitarian dictatorship of Ceausescu. And my father was a diplomat, and my mother was, she would hate to be called this, but I would call her an agitator. And she was meeting with oftentimes the wives of people who had become political prisoners for speaking out against the dictatorship. They were democracy activists. And she was trying to assist them to be able to leave the country and to find refuge in other countries. But I and my brother were often the front. We were the excuse to go to some cold, sort of dark Romanian apartment building. And I would have to endure French lessons by somebody to distract whoever was listening in from the real conversation, which was being had with my mother. And I gotta confess, I appreciate it now in retrospect, but I really hated it then.
So I'm curious, how old were you when you were getting French lessons?
Like 10 and 11, 12, just that pre-teenage where you want things to be comfortable, and this wasn't comfortable. But what it was an inspiration about how people can change their circumstance.
I'm curious, though, as a child, I mean, that's a pretty risky thing to be doing as an adult, but as a child, did it feel risky? Did it feel scary in any way?
You know, I think that all of us, when we're growing up as children, have some type of challenge that we're faced with, and then you begin to think it's normal. And I think for me, it was sort of the thing that you did after school. You went and got horrible French lessons, which you didn't really need, in cold buildings while your mother tried to encourage political prisoners to see a way out.
But this changed when you went to Israel.
When I went to Israel, I came at a point of change. So we have a bit of a joke in our family that every time we leave a country, there's regime change. We left Moscow, and you know, Brezhnev and many other leaders had died, and we brought in Gorbachev and left Romania just after the revolution. And in Israel, I left just after the famous handshake between Sharon and Arafat. And so it was a period of intense conflict. And at the same time, it was an opportunity for me then as a high school student to be able to really engage in debate and dialogue and learn for myself where my convictions lie and how to defend those and how to be able to be a voice of the people that seem to be the most voiceless.
Marie, one of the things you said in the green room stuck with me, and I'm going to repeat it here and ask you if you could maybe explain it a little bit more. You mentioned that you had a cellular experience or vision of the next steps in your organization. Where does this vision come from, and when did you start getting these kinds of insights into what had to be done? And change is something that you realize once you see something has to change, then you make it happen. But the realization, where does that come from?
I imagine this would resonate with leaders, whoever is listening in other places, that there's a moment where you can tap into that sort of still small voice inside that can picture the world you're trying to create or the business you're trying to create. And suddenly there's this sort of cellular experience of how to follow the pathway to get there. And the trick then is to be able to communicate that to other people. I think oftentimes we can get lost when we fail to build that team that we heard about earlier to be able to actually realize that change.
A lot of people are called to nonprofits and serve and try to make a difference around the world, but you seem to have been able to really relay that vision and rise very quickly. What would you say would be the your primary strength, which has led you to such a quick rise to the management position that you're at?
Again, I think it's about both vision and communication and trusting that that you don't do this work alone. You always do it in community. And a real belief in the work that we're trying to do around the world. And when you have that real commitment and belief and vision, you're willing to give 150% into that work. And people around you then resonate with that drive, and if they are inspired by that vision, then they'll come together and realize a change. I think the other thing that's really important is to recognize that that the senior leaders are only one mouthpiece of that change, but the really deep thing that will turn around poverty in the world, that will address hunger, is the agency of people who are in poverty and people who are hungry. And our job is, as a nonprofit, is to be able to promise to support them and be a wind at their back, and whatever we do to keep those promises. So we can't slack off. We need to be able to rise to those hurdles so that we can keep those promises.
When you look back on your very interesting upbringing and your mother's agitation and your father's diplomacy, were you acting as a wind at people's back then too?
I hope so. I hope that in my life I've always been wind at people's back. I know I take the energy. It's like a cycle, actually. So, for example, right now I'll be traveling in a couple of weeks to Bangladesh, and undoubtedly we'll be speaking with women smallholder farmers that are sort of building their business and thinking about how they invest in their own business, the risk that they take, the incredible amount of burden of caring for their children and their business, and engaging in the marketplace. I know that I will come back then and think, okay, in ActionAid USA, how do I invest? How do I balance my motherhood of my two small children and be wind at their back as newly formed change agents, just, you know, 5 and 7, and at the same time be really supporting my colleagues in being able to shift things for that woman smallholder.
So you brought up a really important question, being a parent and being a successful business leader. What are the similarities?
I think, again, that as a parent, the trick is to be able to help encourage your children to think creatively and to be active leaders in their own lives, to craft their own lives, to empower them, and to be able to learn from them and listen to them as well. And sort of in the same way, as an executive director, I really value my colleagues, and I value the people we work with at even the village level as being creative people that are rising to challenges that in many cases are much harder than the ones that I have to rise to every day. And so try and encourage that and be wind at that back.
What's the website?
www.actionaidusa.org.
This is Dana Theus. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining me for this segment is Doug Kay, who is a principal with a firm called Offit Kerman. What is Offit Kerman, Doug?
Offit Kerman is a full-service law firm in the Mid-Atlantic region, with offices from Philadelphia all the way down to Tysons Corner, Virginia, where I work.
Right. And you're a lawyer with the firm?
I'm a lawyer with the firm.
What practice area do you specialize in?
I mostly do work in commercial litigation, although I also do work in doing criminal defense and personal injury, anything that gets me to trial.
Anything that gets you to trial. Well, why do your customers appreciate you?
I think they appreciate me because I am a careful and sympathetic listener, and I try to offer concrete solutions to their most vexing legal problems.
Well, give us an example. Do you have, without mentioning specifics, a recent example of where you were really good at this?
Hmm.
How about your favorite client up till now, without getting into too particulars there?
Well, I represented a fellow who was in a commercial lease, and the landlord was determined to make him pay more than he should have been paying. And we had to go to court, and we had to go all the way through trial, and the client really appreciated the effort, and we got an excellent result for the client. And that was very satisfying, and since then he's been talking me up all over town, so I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. What's the best part of practicing law for you?
I would say that it is taking people through difficult circumstances when they think they don't have any options and trying to find a good solution for them.
Great. What's the website address for the law firm?
www.offutkerman.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Kay, who's the principal with Offutt Kerman. This is Peter Schwartz, and that was your Business Spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. Welcome, Jody. Jody, what is Acumetrics?
Acumetrics is a firm that works with CEOs that are interested in growing their revenues and bottom lines in a scalable, sustainable way.
And what's your role within the company?
I'm the founder and president.
And what is it about the job that you bring that's so unique to you, that special gift, as we say?
That special gift? I enjoy working with the CEOs to have them achieve goals that they thought were impossible.
And what is it about the organization that makes it so special?
Our clients say that it's the three P's: our people, our platform, and our processes. Our people are highly qualified, and they're fun to work with. Mm-hmm. Our processes are enabling of reliable and timely financial information, and our platform is scalable.
And who is, or what is, perhaps, the perfect client for you?
Businesses of any size that want reliable, timely financial information.
Mm-hmm. And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I enjoy working with the clients and making a difference. We like to help the CEOs understand their financial information so they can make different choices tomorrow to impact future results of the business.
That's great. What's the website for the company?
www.acumetricsllc.com.
Thank you, Jody.
Thanks, Les.
We've been speaking with Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
Joining us for this Business Spotlight is Wes Burnett, partner at Optifor. Wes, what is Optifor?
Optifor is a securities firm that integrates legal, tax, and financial and risk in order to offer optimal results for clients.
Who's your perfect client?
Perfect client is someone who actually would like to combine services, make their life simpler, and is very family-oriented. Our firm itself is very family-oriented. We love helping families take care of their own, and that can be multi-generational.
So what would a family need when they would come to you?
Typically, what they're doing is trying to simplify their personal life by trying to have somebody else worry about their legal and their tax and financial affairs and present them with solutions rather than questions.
Solutions rather than questions. So give us an example of a good solution.
A good solution is something that results, for example, in the lowest tax bill, the greatest savings, and taking care of the values important to the family, like saving for college for children or grandchildren or something along those lines.
So what do you enjoy most about your work?
My clients. Although a second place, close, would be my staff, because I recruit very specifically people who have the same values as our clients. So we truly are very involved with our clients' lives, and they are family to us.
What about your family? Are they in the business too?
No, although there's certainly plenty of lawyers and financial advisors and so on in the business. But no, they all have their own lives, and we're very pleased, quite frankly, with that. I actually have a wife who's a teacher for 42 years, so I take a lot of my values from her.
What is the website?
Optifor.com, OPTIFOUR.com.
Thanks for listening to this Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis. Next up, we have Tony Braddock, CEO of Lock Harbor Group. Tony, what is Lock Harbor Group?
Beta, we're a professional services corporation working consulting for both private industry and the public industry, doing consultant work for both areas.
And you specialize, don't you?
Yeah. Well, we specialize in numerous areas, many functional areas. Professionally, one of the areas that we're involved in is in information technology area, where we do a lot of information assurance and cybersecurity. We are also involved with Department of Defense, another agency, and the Veterans Administration of Affairs, and some private industry work.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in northern New Jersey, in Hudson County, in a blue-collar area. my parents were blue-collar type.
What were they doing?
I'm sorry?
What were they doing?
My father was a ferry boat captain. He captained ferry boats from 42nd Street, New York, to Weehawken, New Jersey, back and forth. That was his job. My mother was an embroidery sewer for a factory there in West New York, New Jersey. We grew up, my brother and I grew up there in Hudson County, and I was more of a sports guy. I played baseball and basketball and football, and, you know, all those things you're growing up with those years.
So you were a ball player as a kid.
Ball player as a kid. When I went to college, I was a ball player also, and from college I went into the military, and I played some ball there in the military, but not much, not much. I was doing a lot of traveling there. First 7 years of my military career, I spent 4 years overseas in four different countries, and learning different cultures personally, you know. But more so, my growing up years, it was the relationships that I had with ball players from different high schools and different areas within Hudson County where we played ball.
So I'm curious, you come across as a ball player, and I'm wondering if you're still playing ball today.
Well, those only mentally. those years are gone. You know, but I do get on the bicycle, do the bicycle work there at the house, and I do walk, try to keep in shape as best as I possibly can, but those days are gone.
So what does it mean to be a ball player mentally?
Be a ball player mentally, if you have a goal in life and you can reach that goal, yeah, that's a good mental possibility. You know, like one of my main sport was baseball, and baseball I played, got to the semi-pro leagues, and had maybe an outside chance of playing professional baseball, but the other things came into view at the time, and it really wasn't as lucrative as it is nowadays.
I'm betting, though, that between your ball playing and your youth, your military experience, you're a good team player, and that has a lot to do with your business success.
Absolutely. It's a good point, Dana, that you bring that out, because without having that background, being able to converse and get along with people, be competitive, without that, some of the things that you use when you're in business like this, because my business, what you have to do is you have to, a lot of personalities, make contacts, move with people, get with people, schmooze them, and what have you, both in industry and in the government arena.
So I'm curious, your dad was a ferry boat driver. Did you ever have to go to work with dad?
Oh, yes. there were times when I had to sit on the ferry boat going back and forth between New York and New Jersey for several hours.
Was it fun or was it boring?
Well, no, it was fun because in the captain's area there was, when he was guiding the ship, he used a small wheel, which was up front. Behind him was an emergency wheel that you could use, and we kids would just keep on playing with the big wheel, had no connection at the time to steering the ship because it was... The connections were taken away.
You said you had a brother, or you have a brother. What were the dynamics like of the relationship back then, and what are they like today?
Well, put it bluntly, he was more in the automobile industry. I shouldn't say industry, but he was into making mechanical with the cars. I was more into sports. So he went one way, I went another way. And I guess it through my years doing the traveling that I did with the military and still do traveling, he's more of a home body. He doesn't really get around as much as I do. I enjoy traveling, I enjoy meeting people, I enjoy seeing different cultures, and learning a couple of phrases and statements that these people make, the different languages, you know. So I enjoy it. And I, in where I'm living right now, if I may, there's a lot of Korean people that live there. And when I use some Korean language, they're shocked. An American speaking some Korean, you know. You can see the expressions on their faces, you know. And it's not that I enjoy doing that, but they start smiling and laughing and what have you. And it's interesting. It's interesting.
So, Tony, you mentioned that you had 21 cousins. You all played together, and you were the youngest of the 21.
I was the youngest, yes. Most of them, there's only seven of us left, three boys and four girls. A couple of my cousins were, let me start this way. We come not only from a blue-collar family, but a sports family, in that my father had four brothers and two sisters. Now, four of the five boys were boxers. Back when boxing was seemed to be the trend at the time, back in the 20s and the 30s, and one of my uncles, they all held titles, amateur titles or some professional titles within the state of New Jersey and New York. But my uncle went on to the higher levels of boxing, holding the title, the heavyweight title.
But being the youngest, did you have any special burdens placed on you?
Well, it was sort of like the gopher. You know, get the kid to do it. They need this, they need that, they need the other thing. Tony, go get this. Tony, go get that.
So how did you deal with that?
Well, I always looked at my cousins, looking up to my cousins. I always looked up to them because I was always going to learn something. And they, in a couple of cases, they brought me along and in different areas, especially in baseball. One of them was very instrumental in helping me out to get into some leagues and get into some of the higher levels of baseball, which I was really interested in at the time.
So did that translate at all into your business success?
Well, like I said before, where things get translated is the people-to-people relationships. In the sports, you deal with a lot of different people, different teams, from different areas, and you meet these people, and you learn. In my case, I felt that I learned at an early age that I can translate what I learned back then to what I'm doing right now. That's learning in the business with people.
What's the website?
www.lochharbour.com.
This is Dana Theus. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Offutt Kerman, for hosting us here today. And Mark, would you like to thank our guests?
Sure. We talked to Jerry Carlson, the Washington Metro Area Managing Partner of KPMG LLP. And thanks to them. Also thanks to Robert Bainham, founder and CEO of the Woodlands Retirement Community. Thanks also to Marie Clark Brill, the Executive Director of ActionAid USA. And finally, we just heard from and thanks to Tony Braddock, the owner and CEO of Lock Harbor Group.
And I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for listening, because otherwise we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics. Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Federal News Radio's DoD Wednesday. At 3, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. At 4, in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a smart discussion on the issues and challenges of the defense community. Plus daily DoD updates, mornings and afternoons, Monday through Friday. DoD Wednesday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of